Welcome to the Green Majority, Canada's oldest environmental radio show, the hell of the burgeoning world, just continually spraying up at us in these spumes, these flumes, and these twisting, malevolent floral enterprises of sensation.
Wow.
One is addicted to sensation. One has an experience which is good. And one thinks one would like to have more good experiences.
I mean, I think it's hard to deny that.
So one does one's best at isolating the factors that led to the good experience and repeating those in a repetitive pattern, developing a habit of clinging to structures that are supposed to yield further pleasure.
Well, I mean...
That's addiction. Stefan's addicted, I'm addicted. You, listener, are addicted. We are on CIUT 89.5 FM, or your local community radio station, or your podcast application, Harbinger Media Network. I have taken two weed gummies, and... And Stefan has betrayed me.
I have betrayed you.
And abandoned me. He has essentially cut off my genitalia and left me writhing in the street.
I am the one here trying to bring this all together, and I'm being accused of abandonment.
Bringing this all together? As if I were to have created a shambles for you to then nail together with a crude hammer.
You apparently did just take two weed gummies, so...
Well, I don't know what kind of weed gummies you take. But I take normal weed gummies.
All right.
Stefan looks like a velociraptor.
All right.
Lauren Latour is not here. I do not know why.
She's away for work.
Mm-hmm. Travels a lot for an environmentalist.
I mean, it's Montreal. It's the train, Dave.
And Stefan will be interviewing...
Kim Fry. Yes.
From Music Declares a Climate Emergency.
Canada, yes.
Canada. And what will you be discussing?
The work that they do to try to make the music industry more sustainable. The need for supporting the sort of mid-level artists and their work, so you're not just dealing with the Taylor Swifts of the world and then people who can't make enough money on the project. And the connection between art and activism and the work that they are doing with the Junos.
What are they doing with the Junos?
They are working to reduce the emissions related to the Junos, which apparently come from like 80 to 90% of emissions related to music is how people get there. And so...
No. You mean related to the Junos?
No, to most music. Like, the most emissions...
How people get to the music shows. Exactly. Not how people get to the Junos.
No.
Nobody goes to the Junos.
People go to the Junos, Dave.
Who's going to win this year? When are the Junos?
The Junos are in a couple weeks, Dave. Okay. I believe it's March 24th.
So Stefan will somehow be solving the issue of emissions in an industry that relies on travel.
Well, exactly. We talk about that.
So
it's a really great conversation.
I don't quite understand how Stefan's going to thread that needle, but...
You can keep listening to the show and you will find out.
We're going to talk about some climate news. I feel like we are morons on the show.
Wow.
And we are in existence in the world. Joe Biden recently begged Donald Trump to support him on strengthening the U.S. southern border. Biden said, quote, "You know and I know it's the toughest, most efficient, most effective border security bill this country has ever seen. So instead of playing politics with the issue, why don't we just get together and get it done?" Biden has also been considering executive actions to tighten asylum rules. And he is, of course, still supporting Israel and its genocide against Palestinians. So this is what the new global fascist elite will do with climate change, Stefan. They will starve and they will restrict.
I mean, I truly think one of the more scary things that have happened in the last... It might have been true forever, I will admit. But one of the really scary things I find is just how much overlap that exists between sort of the quote-unquote liberals and conservatives and direct fascists when it comes to borders. Like, you know, the bill that they got that brought that did not pass was considered to be one of the harshest bills in the last 50 years. And here in Canada, you know, you saw Trudeau openly welcome the Prime Minister of Italy, Giorgia Meloni, who was a part of the now-dissolved neo-fascist party, or a now-dissolved neo-fascist party, which was openly apologetic for the dictator Mussolini. And while she's more recently distanced herself from Mussolini, she continues to defend the former party. And then when Trudeau decided to try to throw a gala with Meloni at the AGO, and that was protested both for denouncing Meloni as well as pushing for support for Palestine, other liberal MPs came out and accusing the protesters of anti-Semitism, which means we've come to the place where protesting the ideological descendant of one of Hitler's biggest allies is now somehow anti-Semitism, which just goes to show that they will vilify anyone who does not sort of support this liberal order, which really more has more to do with who is currently in power and the ways in which we want to prevent people from migrating to where they need to be. And as climate change gets worse, and as places have bigger and bigger problems and people need to move, which is one of the big things we know that will happen as climate change worsens, yeah, I mean, it's really terrifying. And truly, I think we have to find a way to rein in the politicians who consider themselves or call themselves progressives around around borders and border rights. The Trudeau government has been terrible about it. The Biden administration has been terrible about it. And it's something we have to find a way to begin to talk about, or we will continue to see it get worse and worse.
I mean, it's not just borders. Like, they're sending them weapons that are then it's the whole colonial project. They're still attempting to wield these large international corporations to remove resources and control populations.
The most important part of that control is the fact that they cannot leave these places. The violence of borders is central to the control because it means that you can keep people out of where you're taking those resources to.
Borders are a large aspect of their need for control, and like the selling out of any real principles in order to maintain it and expand the control. So Mexico City's water reservoirs are running dry and could even run dry this summer, at which point the city will have to use underground aquifers. There are already water restrictions across the city, and in some places there is no running water at all, and everyone has to buy water privately. Mexico City's old water pipes are notoriously leaky, and the climate crisis has been contributing to the water shortage, which some experts say is the biggest threat to the city.
Yeah, and I mean, again, this is one example of the types of things that will happen as climate change gets worse that might mean people must move from where they are. But this particular story is also interesting for another reason. And this isn't the first time that Mexico City has been close to running out of water. Similar thing happened in 2018. This also isn't the first time that major cities have considered almost running out of water. Cape Town actually hit day zero at one point a few years ago, which is when you truly don't have any more water, which we covered in the show earlier. But what this is a great example of is what you'd expect our current system to do when climate change begins to increase scarcity with things like water or other resources, which is that the solution that our system has is to make things more expensive. And so what's happening in Mexico is that as water gets harder and harder to get out of the taps, people are buying water. They're paying money for water trucks to drive in water to them. And so it's having a dramatically less impact on people who can afford these water trucks versus not. And you see versions of this everywhere. You know, California has been in significant droughts while golf courses continue to pull tons of water to keep their grass green. And the people around those golf courses have to keep their water, you know, limited. And so unless we find a way to guarantee these kinds of rights, rights to enough water, rights to food, you know, rights to housing, the ways we are seeing right now that capitalism is basically creating a system where the poor will have to go without. There are parts of Mexico City that have not had water for years because of poor infrastructure. And that is true, obviously, within the states in terms of things like Flint, Michigan, and here in Canada with boil water advisories. So these are, this is not just a Mexico problem, it's a world problem. But we are allowing these things to continue because we're refusing to guarantee people rights to water and food and shelter and life. And without those kind of guarantees, we can only expect these kind of things to get worse and worse. And again, don't expect the system to come out and save these people, because it's already told them that they're not, you know, that it's not helping them now unless we drastically change our ways.
Alberta is putting restrictions on renewable energy for land that is good for farming and land they consider picturesque. So they've been doing, there's been a large renewable boom, and now they're pulling back on renewable energy development in Alberta.
Yeah, so this is the follow-up to the moratorium we covered 6 months ago. And it is honestly worse than I thought it was going to be. What they have done is they've set up buffer zones of a minimum of 35 kilometers around protected areas, or what the government considers quote-unquote pristine views. Pristine views are not a real thing. They have made it up specifically for this regulation, so people don't even know what that means. And the 34-kilometer buffer zone is alone makes up 76% of Alberta cannot have any renewable energy projects because of this rule. And it feels a little like 2015 to point out when politicians are blatantly lying, but the fact that Daniel Smith used the argument that the cold snap in January was an example of why renewables can't be a main part of the mix, while the Alberta Electrical System Operator, or sorry, the Alberta Electric System Operator, says that actually it was due to the gas plants going down and that the renewables actually helped ease the issue, just show how bunk this sort of argument is. And yet, I think if there's one thing to take away from this story, it's that the argument used to be that renewables were too expensive and so we had to use gas and other things. And now that renewables are cheap, we get other made-up arguments, which just goes to show that the only way to win things is through building power, pun intended. Politicians and regulators who are in the pocket of big oil or big gas do not care about the facts. They care about keeping money flowing to fossil fuels. And to give a sense of just how unbelievable this decision is, the moratorium impacted over 100 projects with $33 billion of investment and 24,000 jobs. Can you, the entire oil industry, I believe, in Alberta, employs something like 100,000 people. It might be a little bit more than that, and if, you know, secondary markets, you can debate it. But point is that this is an industry that was absolutely booming, that was bringing in jobs that were significant in numbers, and they just decided they just didn't want it because it, you know, in some ways just because they wanted to believe that oil and gas and their friends were just better. And it's not about the job. This decision will hurt the Alberta economy. It will hurt Albertans because the Clean Energy Canada thinks that renewables could save up to $600 per household because they are literally cheaper than gas. And Alberta was on the cusp of becoming the clean energy champion. The articles about this story talked about Alberta being the undisputed clean energy hub of Canada before this moratorium. And this new decision has been called a quote-unquote uncertainty bomb. But I think it's even worse than that. It sounds like they're just saying, we don't want you at all. And it's, you know, if you want to wonder why it's going to be so hard for Canada to meet its climate targets, it has to be shown that what we've seen time and time again is the moment a conservative premier gets in, the first thing they do is try to take the clean energy industry out by the knees. Doug Ford did it. Daniel Smith is doing it. And if we have any hope of getting to where we need to go, we have to find a way to make that impossible for them. Because if we lock ourselves into gas emissions for the next 20, 30 years, the very hard task in front of us becomes impossible.
The Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation is suing the Alberta Energy Regulator over the tailings pond leak that went unreported for almost a year. So that was when the wastewater leaked into a bunch of rivers, and the government and the company just sort of did not tell the people.
To briefly just go to make one last point about how absurd the Alberta renewable energy decision was that is connected to this story. The Alberta energy legislation requires all projects to prepay for their cleanup before construction can begin, which is something that is not required for oil sites and oil industry. And despite the fact that a recent report indicated that cleanup costs for oil wells in Alberta is $33.3 billion, which is money that we do not, which money that that's how much they think it will cost to clean up the oil wells. And that doesn't include the oil sands and has also been criticized for being too low. And so we're supposed to believe that a wind turbine is somehow more dangerous than the oil industry, while at the exact same time, the Alberta Energy Regulator allows these First Nations communities to be poisoned by tailings ponds for year after year to the point where they are being sued for it. It is an clear-cut example of environmental racism and also a clear-cut example of how captured Alberta is by the oil industry. And anything we can do to support the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation in this process should be done. You can check out, I think it's Environmental Defense has a few posts about it, most recently including the press release from the nation.
Finally, Environmental Defense is reporting, quote, despite having made commitments to reduce the emissions from their investments and reach net zero by 2050, Canada's banks have instead increased their funding in risky oil and gas assets every year since 2020. The banks are also lobbying against climate-related policies. The banks claim they don't need to be regulated since they've set up their own net zero pathways by themselves.
How can we ever accept the concept that any industry doesn't need to be regulated? We've seen time and time and time and time again what happens when we allow for the industries themselves to regulate themselves, which is happening everywhere, or just to avoid regulation altogether. What you get is exactly what's happening. You know, these banks will allow themselves to do anything they want to make as much money as possible, funnel that money into the greenwashing and environmental projects that get all the fanfare. You know, like if you ever wonder why so much money of the banks go into environment stuff, or why it seems almost hard to find environmental projects that are not being paid for in some way by at least one of the major banks, you know, this is the reason why. They've decided it's cheaper and more, you know, and better for them to ignore the hard work of, you know, diversifying their revenue streams, or sorry, the hard work of moving away from investing so much in oil and gas, or holding the companies that they do own or you know, are supporting to account in terms of climate change, and instead have decided that it's more fun to take all the revenue that they get from those things, and or not all the revenue, probably, you know, a small percentage of that revenue, and funnel it into either clean energy investments or clean investments in terms of any type of startups that might make them money down the road, so they're not even losing money on that, or these types of environmental programs that, again, the programs themselves might be doing good work, but if it means they cannot criticize what the banks are doing, then we're undermining our power and letting ourselves sort of sit in the same way and be captured by the industry in the same way that, you know, see Alberta and the oil industry and things like that. And so, like, it's a real challenge out there, honestly. Like, if you are an environmental organization, to be able to push back against the major banks, given how limiting that is in terms of funding, but it's going to be necessary if we're going to see any real action, because the only way that Canada shifts significantly on climate change is if these banks do so.
You're saying Canada will not address climate change unless our banks do?
I mean, these five major banks are such a huge percentage of the Canadian economy. And the fact that even bigger percentage of Canadian, obviously, money goes into the banks because they have such a huge percentage of our economy going into them, that unless the banks... Like, I don't think the banks, I don't expect the banks to lead the way by any stretch. I think they will have to be regulated into compliance. But I think that if the banks want to keep giving out cheap money to the oil industry and other types of fossil fuel industries or things like that, then Canada will not be able to decarbonize fast enough. You know, these banks are part of groups like the Business Council of Canada, which is an industry group which banks are part of, that has pushed for the federal government to label fossil fuels as green under the federal government's proposed sustainable finance taxonomy, which would allow them to go on and on and on about all the green investments they've made while continuing to see things worse. And so what I think is that unless we really actually start regulating these industries significantly more effectively, we will get ourselves into the system where we're probably patting ourselves on the back for success, you know, like, oh, look, all the investments we've made into green energy, look at all the successes we've had, while emissions continue to rise and rise and rise. You know, it's the same thing in the States where, you know, you can shout to the rooftops how effective in new renewable energy some of the programs Biden has put in have been, but they are also producing more fossil fuels than they ever have. And unless we actually see the reduction of fossil fuels and the reduction of overarching consumption and the reduction of these harmful activities, it doesn't matter how many good activities there are, we are still going to see emissions increase and we are still going to move closer and closer to a tipping point which you don't necessarily know exists. And that's what scares me.
And on top of that, moving fast enough, you mean just moving in concert with an imagined, volunteered international effort, really, because there's no official coordination.
Oh no, yeah, there's no official coordination. I mean, the official coordination, the closest is the Paris Accord, which everyone's supposed to, you know, bring in their emissions to, or sorry, they're supposed to report back to, and so that would be the way to do it. But again, I don't think anyone is that the Paris Accord itself is not actually binding, and so each country itself has to find a way to hold itself to account.
We'll go to a music break and come back with Stefan speaking with Kim Fry from Music Declares a Climate Emergency Canada about the music industry and emissions. The Green Majority is entirely listener-supported, and we would take this opportunity to graciously thank every individual donating to our Patreon page. Thank you very much. We are a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network, including other great shows like Left Turn Canada, Big Shiny Takes, and North Untapped. Thank you so much for listening.
If you're just joining us, my name is Stefan Hostetter, and as previewed earlier on the show, we are here with Kim Fry, the coordinator of Music Declares Emergency Canada, and who's also a climate specialist with the Halifax Regional Authority. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
So over the next couple months, we will be talking a little bit more about music and the role that music and art can play in activism. And so this is, I think, a great intro interview for some of those other conversations we'll be having soon. But as a way of introduction, maybe you can tell us sort of how Music Declares. What's the story behind Music Declares and how you got involved?
Sure thing. So I'm close to 50, but I've been doing work on climate since I was a high school student in the early 90s. And the year of the Rio Summit, the Earth Summit, I and some other students at different high schools organized a big high school walkout on Earth Day. And we all walked out, and then we all walked together, and we went to the local hockey arena where we had speeches and music and a big concert. Because at the time, I knew that it's really important if you're talking about these heavy issues that you need to have music, and that culture and the arts play a really significant and important role. And probably also, like, I feel like my politicization came from the music I listened to as a kid, from being like a Beluga grad and growing up on Rappi to Neil Young and Joni Mitchell, like, and then into REM and Tracy Chapman and Peter Gabriel. Like, all the artists that I liked seemed to be pretty political. So kind of got that back then, and I was just a huge music nerd. And then I did a degree in environmental studies, and I've always kind of like skirted around the kind of eco art and media and all of that. So when I worked as a climate campaigner and worked in the environmental movement, I had a young daughter who was very musical. She would get tapped a lot to play at different climate events. And as she grew up, she became like a more established and fairly successful for a 21-year-old musician. But rewind to 2017, and I was one of the people who helped organize the People's Climate March. And we had music, of course. In fact, my daughter played. She was in a little duo, and she was 14 or 15 at the time. And that was one of their first shows together. And then 2 years later, after attending lots of the climate strikes with my class, because I was a teacher by then, and my daughter was going, we heard that in the UK, they had launched an organization called Music Declares Emergency, which was a bunch of well-known, well-established musicians and people who worked in the music industry who were like, hey, what can we do to use the cultural power of the music sector, but also to decarbonize and start to change the practices of the music industry? And we were like, that's so awesome. We should try and start a group like that in Canada. And then when I got pulled in to help organize the 2019 People's, or the 2019 climate strike, global climate strike in Toronto, there were a lot of musicians involved. We organized a concert, and we just noticed how many musicians were engaged and how there was a lot of work being done around the arts and climate. So we started meeting shortly after to try and start an organization similar to Music Declares, and we're getting some headway when COVID hit. And so we kind of took a pause, as everybody did, for a few months. And in the pause kind of ending, heard from the folks in the UK who had started Music Declares Emergency, because we'd reached out to them when they first launched, that there was interest in starting some international organizations. And did we want to start up the Canadian chapter? So we started meeting, and we launched in March of 2021. So we're just coming up on our third birthday.
Amazing. What do you know, a specific day that we can celebrate?
I think it might be March 17th. I have to look, which is when we're holding a concert in Halifax to launch a project of ours, which is going to be the Canadian Environmental Music Awards. So yeah, I think, or the 18th, but right around then.
Amazing. Well, A, happy birthday. and B, I mean, I have a couple other questions, but that seems like a perfect segue into those awards. So can you tell us a little bit about those awards?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, we've long debated whether or not we wanted to do some kind of awards for people who are writing music about environment and climate. We'd heard about the Environmental Music Awards that Australia has. And then there was kind of this sense of like, oh, do we want to make it competitive? But I think I've really come to see, the more I've gotten to know the music industry, that the music industry really likes awards. Like, they really like creating opportunities to celebrate people. That just yesterday it was the Women in Music Awards, and there's Live Music Awards. It's like kind of a part of the music industry. There's of course the Junos, right? So we're like, we're asking people to both be part of the storytelling and the creating of art that addresses climate and environmental themes. We need way more people doing it. and we want to encourage it. This seems like a good way to do that. It seems like a great way to shine the light on the people who are already doing that. It seems like a great way to honor that this is like a long-standing Canadian tradition of having artists Neil Young, Joni Mitchell, you know, like top of mind, who've been writing music, addressing these themes for half a century. And so, yeah, we decided that it just seemed to make sense as a cool project. And we want to both honor the people making the art that addresses those themes, but also people who are innovating in terms of like green music production or greening their tours or developing sustainable merch, and sort of like honoring the people both behind the scenes within the music industry or the music sector and the artists kind of at the front of the stage. And so the awards will hopefully do both of those things.
Awesome. And so you mentioned also there are the Junos, which are coming up also in March. And I know that you're doing some work with them. So can you talk about what that looks like?
Yeah. So, you know, the Junos are probably the biggest night or event in the Canadian music industry. Of course, there's people out there who say, you know, for awards like the Junos or the Brits or the Grammys are irrelevant, and they miss a whole bunch of artists, or they're always celebrating the same people. Like, there's lots of critiques of them, and many of those critiques are absolutely, you know, like valid. But awards are a really big opportunity, just like I said, with our own developing our own awards, where everyone sort of comes together. And so, and the Junos are broadcast and lots of people watch them, and so it's like a way to really to connect with a lot of people. The Junos are also interesting and different than the Grammys, say, which always take place in LA, and that they move around, and so different Canadian cities will host the Junos, and they're more than just the awards. There's a whole week of activities leading up to it. In fact, months before, there's a local host committee. And so we decided that it would be really great to talk to the Junos about how they could A, be more sustainable, and B, incorporate messaging about the climate and ecological emergency. So we've been trying for a couple of years. It's been a bit tricky. But then when I found out they were going to be in Halifax, which is where I happen to live now, I was like, okay. So last April, we organized an event at the Halifax Public Library to sort of start thinking about and musing about, like, what would it mean to be more sustainable and to have a more sustainable Junos. And I reached out. At the time, I was not working for the Halifax Regional Municipality. I was teaching and doing Music Declares work, and reached out to the Halifax Regional Municipality because they would be an important player, and they participated in the panel and they were really great. And I learned of all the amazing things that are happening with the Halifax Municipality around climate. Really enjoyed working with those folks for that event. And so we were, I guess, campaigning or lobbying the Junos to figure out how they could be more sustainable, and kind of came up with a little plan we presented to them. And so kind of through both of those things, it was decided they would establish for the first time ever a sustainability subcommittee as part of the local host committee. And so I'm on that committee, I've been co-chairing that committee, and we came up with a whole bunch of ideas, got some funding, and we're doing a lot around transportation, because most of the carbon emissions related to the live music sector, like about 80 or 85%, comes from audience travel and how audiences get to shows. So we really kind of focused in on that. And so I'm doing things in my capacity as working for the city, for the Halifax Regional Municipality, but then Music Declares is also doing some events, like launching the Canadian Environmental Music Awards. We're hosting a mini summit. And then there's some things that are involving both of those. Like, we're doing a climate stage outside of the Halifax Central Library for 4 days. And that stage will be entirely pedal powered and solar powered. So it'll be a off the grid stage that will be programmed for 4 days with free music. So we're kind of showcasing, like, we can do it differently. Here's how we can do that. We're doing a whole big campaign to encourage people in Nova Scotia to get to the awards by public transit, or riding their bicycles or carpooling, just thinking about getting to the shows differently. And so as part of that, we lobbied to get Halifax Transit to extend the service of the ferries and to have some special shuttle buses, which they're going to do, and a free hop on, hop off bus that will kind of just kind of circulate through the downtown area just for the Junos. So we're doing some really interesting things and really trying to think about like how we can meaningfully reduce the emissions and make this production of the Junos and this Juno celebration more thoughtful and more grounded in climate.
Yeah, that's so interesting because I find that, or have felt that one of the big questions that I think comes up as I think through us moving towards a more sustainable world is, you know, what joy and celebration and, you know, fun looks like, right? Because so much of what we currently do in society, or so much of what's currently pushed in society for these things, are consumption based, right? Yep. They are go buy something, hang out in a shopping mall, you know, order stuff to your house and then do things. You know, like there's so much consumption that is based right now in our current ways of enjoyment. And that's shifted in some ways as, you know, things have moved online. But then, of course, then there's the energy draw of streaming services. And so everything has a cost. But for me, one of the things that I always figured was like the least carbon and sort of the least impactful on the world in some ways is just being together. And obviously you see this not always the case, because so often when you end up in places like big festivals and stuff like that, to manage that many people, they end up going with really disposable things. And so you do run into this problem where tons of people in one space create some logistical challenges in terms of trying to ensure that you're not overusing disposables. But really, to me, the hope for me would be that the place we could find real change and real joy within a low carbon world would be within these types of gatherings. And so music, to me, it makes a lot of sense in that way. And I'm curious what your sort of thoughts on that are, and also what you're sort of hoping to inspire with your work at the Junos.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with you that we need moments of joy. I think music festivals are kind of like potentially, not always, revolutionary places of people just stepping outside of their regular life and like being in a collective with other people. And I think there's profound possibility in music festivals. And interestingly, Ian Garrett, who teaches at York University and runs the Center for Sustainable Practice in the Arts, we've done some work with them, told me, and he's done more analysis on this than I have, that if you have 1,000 people going to, say, Massey Hall for a show, assuming that those people are like not in their homes for those couple of hours, so their lights are turned out and they're not watching television, if they were to all take public transit or ride their bikes or walk to that music venue, there's a net gain because they're all together. They're not in their homes. So it's actually better for that period of time and drawing less energy. You know, even if we factor in like there may be some disposable stuff, it's still a net benefit. So the thing is how we get people to shows and to concerts, which really raises an interesting question, because the music industry doesn't control necessarily how much governments invest in public transit and in infrastructure. But they could potentially, and we're trying to leverage the music sector, to actually advocate more, because there's been a lot of talk, especially in Toronto, around saving the nighttime economy. And what do we do? Well, cutting service and raising fares of public transit hurts the nighttime economy hugely, especially when you see Ubers doing surge pricing, etc. So a good, resilient, well-funded, reliable public transit system is actually good for the nighttime economy. It's good for live music. And when we bring people together, there's a sense of community. And there's also like, it actually is better for climate. So I think, you know, we're really experimenting with what can music venues or music festivals do besides obviously advocate for better investments. And we did something really interesting last month where CBC, who's the broadcaster for the Junos, had an event in Halifax called Road to the Junos. It was 5 nights, the same venue, different East Coast artists. And they invited us to activate and participate with them. So what we did is sent a communication to all ticket holders, encouraging them to take public transit, to walk or to cycle or carpool. And if they did, they could come and see Music Declares Emergency at our table, and only they could enter a ballot for a contest. And then at every intermission, I got up, I spoke about Music Declares Emergency, talked about our campaign, why we were doing it, and selected people to win free Juno's wristbands or tickets to the concert on March 17th. And we had hundreds of people throughout the week fill in ballots. We had so many people tell us that it got them taking public transit for the first time since COVID, or carpooling with their friends. And so it really, like, was quite impactful. It was a bit of an experiment. We've done similar tables before, but we've only communicated through social media, like, more passively. But this was an active, like, what you need to know for this concert. Everyone got that email, and it made a huge difference. So there are things that music venues can do around the transportation piece. And so that's why we're really emphasizing it in what we're doing for the Junos. But it's not like, well, we're just doing this for the Junos. We're trying to create structures and campaigns and ways of thinking that will live well beyond.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. And yeah, and again, is the sort of thing that we need, like, we need more people to start taking transit again. We need to shift the culture of moving towards transit. And I mean, as people have seen, the times transit is drastically the best way to leave a really big venue. You know, a couple weeks ago, there was a post about it was a long exposure, or sorry, a time lapse of people leaving a concert, 50,000 people leaving a concert, and it's like going to the trains and getting on the train and coming out, and then new people show up and then getting out. And it was just showing how many people use this in a short period of time. And it is undeniable, I think, that transit and walking and biking are so much better at moving large sums of people from places. Like, every other time you try to do it, you try to drive out of the Sky Dome after a baseball game, for example, it's going to take you 3 hours to leave the parking garage. Yeah. And that's true about any number of these venues and any number of these places. And so, yeah, to me, that public transit piece is not only great for carbon emissions, but also for the experience. It's just so much easier and safer for everyone.
Yeah, and fun, right? Like, you're high after the concert. You're, like, so excited, and then you're with on a subway car with, like, all these other fans of that music. I mean, and it, you know, this is a very big city, maybe focused way of thinking about it, but we've been, like, trying to find funding to experiment with music buses. So if you think about, like, people come into Toronto from Guelph, from Waterloo, from Hamilton, from London, from Oshawa for shows, and they may take the GO train, but it might not go out to the suburbs in a time that's going to work for them. But what if you, and this goes back to the, like, we of course, people want to go see their favorite big megastars at the Scotiabank Arena or those big venues. But we need to be supporting the smaller artists and the mid-range artists, right? Because we sort of have a weird culture. If you look at most of the young artists who've made it big in the last 5 years, there, many of them were actors or they're nepo babies, right? Like, you don't have a lot of people who are young who are kind of grinding it out, playing a 100 cap show and then a 500 cap show or venue and then 1,000, kind of moving their way up. They kind of get propelled into superstardom, and then everybody else who isn't in that, you know, Olivia Rodrigo or Taylor Swift or Harry Styles level is suffering and hurting. So you have a small, I mean, kind of like endemic of like how late stage capitalism works in every sector, but you have this like less than 1% of musicians who are doing incredibly well and like becoming billionaires, right, from touring. And then you have the rest of the 99% of musicians who are struggling to make ends meet. And the only ones who can kind of sustain themselves are ones who come from incredible wealth or like families with huge connections in the entertainment industry. So how do we come up with systems that acknowledge that people are going to go see Harry Styles And I'm going to go see Neil Young this summer, right? We're going to go see those big stars. But how do we support also more local music? So we want to do these buses. So like imagining people are going into Toronto to say see Neil Young, and there's enough people from Whitby, Oshawa, Bowmanville to fill a bus, and you figure out a way that you get them all in a bus together, and it like picks them up, and it's all Neil Young fans. But then you find an artist from that local area who's going to appeal to Neil Young fans, and they do little pop-up concerts, right? For all the people getting on that bus, they go on that bus, they get a free ticket to the concert, and you're exposing them, and you're then encouraging all those people to be like, hey, thanks for taking this bus. This is a really great climate initiative. This artist is going to do a concert in your area in a few weeks. You all need to get tickets and go see them, where you can ride your bike or walk to the venue. And don't only go to the big shows and downtown Toronto where you're paying hundreds of dollars, this guy's going to play for $20, right? And maybe they'll become the next big star and you're supporting. So like really trying to pair the work we're doing around climate with also trying to build a better local music culture.
I mean, and to me, that also is a climate solution, right? Like for me, the need for a working musician, you know, the need for musicians that can make a living, you know, not billionaires, but just like make a decent living there where they can survive to live in the city they live in and experience their life is so necessary if we're going to live in a world that doesn't fall into this sort of hyper consumerist trap, right? Like if you are going out and listening to your local, your local show that has like 50, 100 people out in the, but that's enough money for these bands to make enough money. Like it is true how hard it is right now for musicians to make money. Like bar bands don't make enough money anymore. Like that's not really a job. Like it should be a job, but it's not currently paying enough money to be a job. And so we're losing so much of this sort of like culture of just existing in your own much more local space. And so everything, you're right, is either this super hyper huge space, which, you know, then they're flying all around the world and they're doing all the other stuff, or so local that the artists aren't making any money at all and it's not a job. And like, to me, the vision of the future that makes any sense is the middle, where, you know, artists are traveling around, but they're not going all across the world. They're not jet setting to make all the money they need to make. They can make a living off playing the shows near them. And the people who are going to those shows are experiencing, you know, some version of a local culture that we've lost a bit as things have sort of stretched for the, you know, the haves and have nots. You're right. It has done that to everything we live in. And it's very weird. But I want to get into two more questions. The first is about the topic we'll be going on a little bit about with some of these other musicians we'll be talking to soon, is around this concept of like the role of art and music in activism and in global change and shifting political change. And so how do you think about that? And how do you sort of, you know, like obviously that drives Musique Declares, but I'm curious to sort of how you think about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think about it all the time. I mean, I think about how in talking to friends whose parents came in the 70s from like Chile and Argentina and Brazil, like when there was dictatorships, and like reading and learning a little bit more about those, that, you know, like some of the first people that would get jailed would be the union organizers, of course. But the political musicians were way up there because they knew that musicians have the ability to like massively like rally people together. And if you think about like the role that music played in the civil rights movement, or that music is played in like LGBTQ liberation struggles, or, you know, in like indigenous sovereignty movements, like music is central to so many different social movements. It brings people together. It gives them hope. It gives them courage. It's like a unifying force. And so I think that art and social change just like go hand in hand. And I think that movements that don't tap into the arts are kind of doomed to fail. And, you know, what's interesting for me is coming out of COP28, there was a whole big sign on asking for more resources and more space and time to be given to the role of culture, like that we've relied too much on scientists and policymakers to be communicating about climate and they're not reaching most people. We need artists and like culture and creative spaces to be communicating about culture or climate as well. And I think that, you know, we need stories, we need storytellers, and we need visions of the future that we're all kind of working towards. And that comes from artists. I think art, and not just music, like visual art and theater and even like dance, all film and TV, like really sit with us. They live with us differently than a statistic or a number of like, you know, this many parts per million. Like, that's good. I'm not saying we shouldn't have that, but we need art to like crack open our hearts. Like, the minds have been reached through the narratives of policymakers and scientists. And what we need is for people's hearts and souls to be engaged. And I think that is where art comes to play.
Amazing. And so if folks want to support Musica Clara's or learn more about all the stuff you said, how can they do so?
Yeah, so we're online, Musica Clara's. If you go to musicdeclares.net, you'll see there's a whole bunch of flags for each country. So you can find the Canadian flag. We're also on Instagram and we're pretty active. So that's kind of like the best way to keep up with us. We're not so great at updating our website because it's a bit convoluted because it's an international website. So if you are on Instagram or Facebook, you can follow us there. And we are going to be launching this year a kind of a fan engagement campaign. We're looking for some funding for it, but that will get music fans signing up. And then every month we'll kind of have a campaign that they can participate in or an issue that they can work on and sort of like have a way of connecting in with music fans. We've been very focused on artists and musicians, people in the music industry, but we see a lot of music fans who want to get involved. And so the UK chapter just launched it at the Brits last week. We're not quite ready to launch it as part of the Junos, but we definitely, if you love music, get in touch. We're doing lots of work at festivals and we're always looking for volunteers.
Amazing. So this has been Kim Fry, coordinator of the Musica Clara's Climate Emergency Canada. Thank you so much for your thoughts. It's our tradition, that's what I'm looking for, to give our guests the last word of the show. So is there anything that you would want folks to know about or remember from this interview? Now is the time.
Support musicians and artists who are making music for social change. And don't, you know, people will be like, oh, I can't really afford to go to this concert or that concert, but they'll spend $500 to get tickets to see Taylor Swift and fly to go see her. And like, if you're going to do that, like, I mean, question if you need to do that, but if you're going to support those kinds of big artists and do that kind of travel, then take half of the amount of money that you're doing for that and go on Bandcamp and find some emerging artists and support them.
It's not easy.